Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So maybe you've heard this news. It broke during our show yesterday, and we mentioned it briefly, that a federal appeals court in Boston has ruled that the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, that 1996 federal law that defines marriage as only a union between a man and a woman at the federal level, is unconstitutional. At issue here is that the law, according to the court, violates the constitutional rights of gay couples by denying them the federal benefits afforded to other married couples legally married in their states. So here to help us understand this ruling is Yale Law Professor William Eskridge, who has researched and written extensively on the legal protections of gay couples in this country. Hey, Bill Eskridge, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much, Brian.
So we should clarify that DOMA is made up of different sections, and this particular federal appeals court ruling addresses specifically one clause. What is that clause?
That's exactly right, Brian. Part of DOMA was intended to allow states to discriminate against out-of-state same-sex marriages, and that was not at stake in yesterday's ruling. The provision that was at stake was a very simple provision which said that for purposes of federal law, both statutes and regulations, the terms marriage, married, and spouse can only refer to different sex couples, even if same-sex couples are legally married in one of the states of the United States. And that was the provision at issue yesterday that Judge Boudin for the First Circuit struck down.
Is this in, and yet the ruling is almost symbolic in nature, in that the three justices involved here have stayed their own ruling. In other words, this does not throw out DOMA tomorrow, because they anticipate that this is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and be ruled on at that highest level on this constitutional question. So it doesn't take effect right away. Does it automatically go to the Supreme Court?
Oh, no, not at all. First of all, someone would have to file an appeal, probably Paul Clement, because the Obama administration probably agrees with the ruling. It was not the rationale that they had set forth, but they agree with the result.
In fact, the Obama position, for people who don't remember this, is that he has ordered the Justice Department to stop defending the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, because he and, I guess, Attorney General Holder have come to the conclusion that it's not constitutional. Now, that's a very unusual step, because usually the federal government, the Attorney General, will defend whatever federal laws are in effect. But here we have the president saying this federal law is unconstitutional, correct?
That's exactly right. His rationale was even more powerful than the First Circuit's. Attorney General Holder and the president believe that sexual orientation discrimination is subject to the highest level of scrutiny. It's a suspect classification and not just an ordinarily suspicious one. And that was much more ambitious than where the First Circuit went yesterday. So they're taking a very aggressive position in terms of the unconstitutionality, not just of DOMA, but of any discrimination against lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, and transgendered Americans.
Give me a sense, even though I know it's probably fair to say you're on the side of this court ruling, and you would say for yourself you think DOMA is unconstitutional. But how would the other side argue for the constitutionality of it on things like the example I brought up a couple of times before you came on? You can be legally married in New York State, but prohibited from filing your federal tax return as married. Can the Constitution really allow that? What would Paul Clement or anybody else stand up and say to that?
Well, the Clement argument will certainly be, first of all, that any kind of tax legislation or benefits legislation, which is what we're dealing with in these particular cases, the Supreme Court has subjected discriminations and differentiations in those kinds of laws to the most lenient form of review, what they call rational basis review. And under that very lenient test, Clement would argue, not only does Congress have wide power, But the court has got to bend over backwards to speculate and to accept speculations that might support the rationality of the statute. So in other words, put another way, only if a sort of babbling lynch mob could have passed this statute will it fail rational basis review. That should be Clement's argument. And that Judge Boudin in the First Circuit gave stricter, more exacting scrutiny than the U.S. Supreme Court has ordinarily given to tax, Social Security, and other economic legislation, which make all sorts of differentiations, discriminations, and distinctions, which have generally been upheld.
This was a unanimous 3-0 ruling by this federal appeals court in Boston. You mentioned the chief judge there, Michael Boudin. He was appointed by a Republican president, wasn't he?
Yeah, Brian, the chief judge is Chief Judge Lynch, I believe.
Oh, sorry.
Who was also on the panel. Boudin was one of the most eminent corporate lawyers of the 20th century before he was named to the First Circuit. So this is not only a Republican appointee, but he is arguably the most eminent Republican appellate judge in the country, lower than the U.S. Supreme Court. He's certainly one of a handful. Very thoughtful fellow, not a activist judge, a careful lawyer, probably the brainiest law clerk that Henry Friendly, who was the best judge of his generation, ever had, according to the new Henry Friendly biography. There are not enough good things to say about Michael Boudin as a legal analyst. And the fact that he wrote the opinion, I think, will give it extra oomph if it gets to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Who was the Republican president? It was George H.W. Bush, right?
Yes, Bush. I think it was Bush 41, the older Bush.
Let's take a phone call. Tim in Baldwin, you're on WNYC. Hello, Tim.
Hi. I have just something that bothers me very much about the conversation. There's a very big difference between rights and benefits, and we lump them together as one simple cause. Heterosexual, homosexual couples should be entitled to the same rights and benefits. And on the surface, this seems obvious, but that's not the case at all in terms of marriage. The marriage benefits were designed at a time when marriages were supporting one spouse that had to stay home with children. And so Social Security benefits were passed on between spouses because both weren't able to work. Whether it's a heterosexual or a same-sex couple that are living together in a union, if there aren't children involved, those benefits should not apply. The rights, of course, everyone is entitled to the rights of association, no matter what they happen to be, unless they impinge severely on the rights of others.
But, Tim, isn't that a whole different conversation as to whether the tax laws, for example, married, filing jointly, or the way Social Security is allocated, and, of course, a stay-at-home parent does not accrue Social Security credits, but that's a whole different conversation than whether the law could apply its standards differently to married couples legally married in their state based on heterosexual or homosexual?
Yes, it's a totally different conversation because it makes a distinction between rights and benefits. And what we're doing is we're lumping them together as if they were one thing. A person's right to associate, a person's right to lifelong commitment to another person, those are human rights, no issues. There's no one should have any objection to that except on religious grounds, which have no basis in the Constitution. But on the question of benefits, which is basically social engineering, an attempt to create a society that supports families or whatever, these are something that have to be very clearly distinguished, and they're not even being discussed. We're saying, well, why shouldn't a gay couple have the right to Social Security the same as a married couple? Well, whether they're married and you know, could be a heterosexual couple who's married with no children, never had children, never had an interest in having children. Why should they get any benefits that were intended when five children families were the norm prior to 1950? And benefits were absolutely essential to protect the family.
All right. Tim, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Maybe we should do a separate segment on that. Eric?
Well, Brian, let me interject right there.
Please.
The caller is making an important distinction. And the distinction is between liberty rights and equality rights. So he's certainly right to say that one's right to freedom of speech and freedom of expression is different from this anti-discrimination idea. But separate from one's liberty protections, the Equal Protection Clause does tell us that when the government makes distinctions, the government's got to have some kind of good reason to do it. And some kinds of distinctions are particularly fishy. So, for example, take Social Security that the caller invoked. Mm-hmm. When the Social Security Act was originally passed, the standard was not just a heterosexual couple with children. It was a male breadwinner, a female housekeeper, and then children that she was taking care of. And so the Social Security Act traditionally discriminated against female wage earners. And the Supreme Court struck that down because sex is a fishy classification, which the Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled should be subjected to some kind of heightened scrutiny. So the distinction is not between a gay couple and a married couple in this case. It's between a married couple that just happens to be gay, and a lot of them raising children, I might add, versus a straight couple that just, you know, happens to be straight, often raising children as well. And what Judge Boudin ruled was that the gay married couple, situated exactly the same as the straight married couple, except for their sexual orientation, and I might add the sex of their partners, could not be treated differently, at least based upon the justifications that Congress announced in DOMA in 1996.
That's really interesting. Now, I should mention that opponents and critics worry that by forcing states to recognize gay marriages performed in other states, it could set a bad precedent for federal intervention into other state-enacted laws. Is there a danger here that there's too much federal interference that that gets set up for other areas that are not gay marriage?
Well, I don't believe that the DOMA decision really raises that specter. I do think that Congress very often adopts measures, particularly in welfare and Social Security laws, that often have a coercive effect on states and often a coercive effect on individuals. But none of that was at stake in yesterday's ruling. Yesterday's ruling really is going to have a very marginal effect on the federal budget, on state law, et cetera. The main effect of it is that the states that do recognize same-sex marriage, which, as you know, now include New York as well as Massachusetts, it's now going to be a little bit less of a burden on those states and their citizens, if this is upheld anyway, because they will not have to fill out separate state and tax returns, which is a huge imposition on individuals and creates regulatory nightmares for the states. And so yesterday's ruling, I think, is going to make life a little bit easier for a lot of people.
We are almost out of time. Let me get one more caller in here. Eric in Englewood. You're on WNYC. Hello, Eric.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your continued focus on this really important subject. I'd like to just throw it out there. I've read a few articles that have suggested that when DOMA is repealed ultimately through the courts or otherwise, that it removes the only barrier to gay couples who have immigration issues. And I'd like to, for him just to speak freely on those implications. Is DOMA really the only barrier to the INS and ICE recognizing immigration rights through gay marriage? And if you're legally married in a state, does that mean that you're also entitled to a green card once DOMA's gone?
That's a great question, because marriage entitles you to a green card if you're an immigrant, if you're marrying an American citizen. So what are the implications for that, Bill?
Well, yes, if DOMA is ultimately invalidated, and as Brian pointed out, everything is on hold for now, but let's say the Supreme Court ultimately takes the case and affirms, then either as a result of that ruling or in a subsequent ruling, ipso facto, the immigration laws would start respecting same-sex marriages that would allow some immigrants to come, again, on exactly the same terms as straight couples. So there would be no differentiation in favor of gay couples, but it would be treated the same as straight couples that are married. And remember, the INS, the immigration people, do examine marriages to make sure that they're bona fide. And so that kind of scrutiny would also be accorded to gay marriages as well as to straight marriages. I might also add that immigrants do have a number of ways, whether they're gay or straight, of getting into the country and staying here without marriage. And indeed, asylum protections have been applied by the courts and by the Obama administration, and frankly, the Bush administration as well, to protect gay people who were persecuted in other countries. So there are a lot of cross-cutting issues in the immigration context, and there is some protection for gay people already. This would equalize the playing field if the Boudin ruling is upheld.
How quickly might this reach the Supreme Court?
Well, the First Circuit has already said that it's not going to consider this en banc, that this is going to be the final ruling of the First Circuit. So if Mr. Clement wants to appeal, he's got to do it promptly. It would not be heard this term, even if the Supreme Court took review. It would probably be heard next term, probably sometime in the winter of 2012-2013.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a decision could be reached in June of 2013.
So perhaps.
So it could be within a year that we have a ruling on these particular issues from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Perhaps within a year we'll know if the Defense of Marriage Act is constitutional, ruled unconstitutional by a federal appeals court in Boston yesterday and on its way up the chain. We thank William Eskridge, professor of law at Yale and an expert in LGBT law, his recent book, Dishonorable Passions. Thank you very, very much.
Brian, it's always a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the Flame computer virus unleashed on Iran. What is it? Who did it? What are the implications for future warfare? Stay with us.